Hey Jason, you have used the chase rules for Call of Cthulhu 7th edition. You remember that time that you and your son Wyatt's characters were chasing that half hybrid deep one through the sandy swamps near Innsmouth? Yeah, we used the chase rules, but I think they were so, I mean, I guess it worked so well, and you guys, of course, were much faster and rolled really well. We're able to find it and track it down and then murder poor Wyatt's character's half uncle. Well, we are using the chase rules, so I guess they've blended seamlessly into the game as a whole, and it didn't seem like they were like a subset mini game chase rule because I think they're that simple. So I agree with Joe Richter, believe it or not. And yeah, you've done the chase before.
Pop yourself a beer or a cold libation. Let me tell you how I wrote this little theme. I went and took a call from brother Jason, and he tells me that he has a little dream. He says he needs a backwards intro to begin his podcast, and I ask him, what you got? He said, I'll start off with some talking and some moody clips of popcorn fighting fantasy explorations and some groundless exploitation. Kickstarts that I'm watching and some blind unboxing, full month horror movie marathon. Sometimes I let the dogs come on, contests and of course you know it's all about games. That's a slogan, let's just start with the name. It's the Nerds with the other Jason.
Welcome back to Nerds RPG Variety Cast. I'm your host, Jason. There at the top of the show, we heard Carl, the Geomologist Presents podcast. I had forgotten about that, Carl, but that's a good point. So apparently the chase rules are pretty seamless because I don't remember them being clunky or hard to use. I don't remember you flipping through a bunch of pages of books, although I don't remember what I ate for breakfast this morning. So, you know, that's not saying you didn't flip through a whole bunch of pages. But I think that probably is a vote towards them being not too complicated. So we're still waiting on somebody else to call in and tell us the Call of Cthulhu chase rules are overly complicated and defend that point of view. But this is another mailbag episode. I've got a number of great calls on a couple different subjects, so I kind of want to get into it. Before we do, I'm going to say that I hope that everybody enjoyed the Crawl Movie Monday episode and this month's movie episode, well, December's movie episode, because this will actually come out before December 1st. The day before December 1st. But December's movie episode is the Conan movies. So primarily we're looking at Conan the Barbarian, Conan the Destroyer, and Red Sonja from the 80s. If you want to talk about the 2011 Conan, you can. But, you know, is that really a Conan movie? Or is it just Conan in name only? You don't have to talk about all the movies. You can just pick one to talk about. Up to you. But that's what we're going to do. I need the Conan entries by the 22nd of December, the end of the day, and we'll have a Conan Christmas. That episode will come out on Monday, December 25th, 2023. I think that's all the announcements I have today, so let's open up the mailbag.
Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Well, maybe it's your auntie or a joke by your spouse, but the operator's scream is coming from inside the house.
Hello, Jason. This is Michael, Merc the Meek on Discord. Just wanted to say thank you for the Water Margin forum post. I don't usually do forums, but it was interesting to kind of click through and read some of that. Also in that forum thread is the reference to the podcast that I was referring to, and you could also go to outlawsofthemarsh.com to get to that. It's a read through, essentially more of like a translation summary of the entire Water Margin book. But what's also neat is the author will do asides to explain some of the aspects of Chinese culture that of course, a Western audience wouldn't really understand, especially since it's from the 12th century as well. So I guess that's another added suggestion there. Thanks.
Thank you for those kind words. I will repost the link to that forum thread in the show notes today. That's over in the RPG Pub. It's a thread about water margin. It talks not only about the podcast and the story, but also the RPG. So go check that out. It's very interesting. Also check out the Merc the Meek podcast. The episodes are short, concise, but very interesting, and there's only a few of them out there so far, so it's easy to catch up on. Michael did call again on the topic of comedy and gonzo, but I also have calls from Peter on that topic, so I'll play all the calls together and then respond.
I also wanted to just comment briefly on the whole comedy and gonzo conversation as well. You mentioned you like comedy in your games and you're kind of a beer and pretzel player. I guess I'm similar. I do like comedy in my game, but I'm not too interested in making light of more serious notes or, breaking immersion necessarily. I do tend to like the comedy coming from the situations that the characters are in or something along those lines instead of bringing it from outside. And I don't really like gonzo at all. I don't mind like weird fictiony, Conan the Barbarian stuff, but when you just start throwing in random elements, not a big fan of that. But comedy, yes, all day. Take care.
Hi, Jason. It's Peter, also known as Space Baby again, with a twofer of call-ins to the call-in show. First off, to clarify my earlier comments about gonzo and genre, I fully know that there's tons of comedy at tables. That's not really what I was trying to refer to. I was more speaking about the genre of comedy, and it was more in thought of when adventure and game writers try to make a game that is comedic, 90% of the time they fail. Because comedy is so personal and so cultural on top of that, that it's generally not funny. When they write comedy into adventures, it's really, really hard to convey the same comedy at the table. That is very different in my mind than the organic comedic moments that come up at a table, at everybody's table, all the time, whether a convention play or personal tables, home games. I think that is part of the hobby, but what I was more referring to was the other side of trying to use the genre of comedy, the bigger picture of comedy in your games, and it really generally doesn't work, in my opinion. The other thing is kind of an apology to James Knight. Revelation Space, I don't know anything about. I recommended that game. I listened to what he said, and then I came up with that recommendation. For some reason, when I was calling in to make that recommendation, I had completely changed the game he was looking for to Ian Banks' Culture series. And that's what I was recommending Thousand Suns for. It might work for Revelation Space. I really don't know. Anyway, I hope it does. That's it for me. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, you two, for those calls. As far as comedy in games, I agree. It's better if it's organic and just occurs naturally as opposed to being forced. That said, a recent game, I say recent, in the past year, I've ran a game called Double Trouble. And Double Trouble is based on anime like The Dirty Pair. I don't know if you're familiar with that. The anime I would recommend, and you can find it streaming. It's might even be on Hulu, I think. Maybe not Hulu, maybe Roku. Maybe it's on the Roku channel. I don't know. You can find it. But The Dirty Pair, basically, it's an anime. We're in the future. We have a pair of troubleshooters that are, young women, and They go through these various adventures together, and they usually have rivalries between themselves during the adventures, and it's lots of fun. The manga for The Dirty Pair are hard R, closed X rated, and I would not recommend them for your family, but the show you could watch, you know, with your older kids without a problem. Kind of the same thing with Gunsmith Cats. Is that what's called, Gunsmith Cats? I think that's right. Same kind of idea. It's definitely adult oriented. But it's that kind of idea. And The Dirty Pair, we ran it, and it worked really well to emulate that genre and emulate kind of that comedy tension of that kind of buddy cop thing where there's a rivalry between the two and they're trying to one-up each other. And it actually worked out really well. Maybe I just was very lucky that I had good players in that game. But, you know, that's the most recent game I played that tries to be somewhat comedic, you know, intentionally in the rules. Now, referring to James Knight and Revelation Space, yes, and watch this space for a future episode where we're going to try to get James back on and talk about some of these things, and we may get another guest on who is familiar with Revelation Space and is going to talk about that as well. So just, you know, I'll put a pin in that for right now, and we'll come back to it later on. But I'm going to turn the mic back over to Peter, because we are going to change topics to the gold standard in D&D.
Hi, Jason. It's Peter, also known as Space Baby, calling in response to all the call-ins about the gold standard, which reminded me, I meant to call in to rant about your rant. So, here's my rant. If D&D is not supposed to be a Western medieval game with a gold standard, then why did Gary spend 80% of the DMG making a Western medieval sim game? All the domain stuff, all the structure stuff, all the hireling stuff, all of it is based on Western medieval ideas and history. There's not a lick in there from any other geographic, historic, anything set. The DMG for AD&D First Edition is a Western medieval fantasy sim.
While I will not refute the idea that it's 100% Western European centric, I would refute the idea that AD&D is a simulationist game. It's much more of a gamist game than a simulationist game. Numerous times in the game, we're told that the rules don't necessarily have to make sense, but they work that way because it's a game, and that's how the game goes. So I would push back against the idea of it being a simulation. But I will not argue the idea that it's based on Western European standards. I mean, that's what Gary knew, right? And I don't think that's a problem, but I don't think that changes the fact that when we look at the way the modules are written, and we look at the way the world's kind of built and referred to, it's kind of referred to as, you know, this kind of post-cataclysmic society. And it's kind of run more like Westerns, like the Westerns Gary grew up watching. You know, when characters come into town and interact and leave, it's set up much more like an American Western than a Western European feudal society, right? I'll include some links in the show notes to some blog posts that talk about this, you know, post-cataclysmic or post-apocalyptic society that's implied in the D&D rulebooks.
And even if you didn't want to go read the blog posts, just think about the earliest settings in D&D. Things like Tekkimil, you know, the Empire of the Petal Throne. Things like Judges Guild Wilderlands. Things like Dave Hargrave's Arduin. All these are post-apocalyptic societies. They all, now Tekkimil predates D&D, but these others kind of tapped into this feeling that was there and built on it. I don't think it's any kind of coincidence that all these early settings were post-apocalyptic settings. I think it, you know, it was just something maybe we don't recognize as easily today, but it was there in the zeitgeist and everybody was building on it. Kind of baked into the implied setting,
because of that.
But we do have another call on the topic, so I'm actually going to turn the mic over to MW, the world's MW Lewis. Now, this is a 7-minute call, so you may want to get something to fortify yourself before you keep listening. It's okay to pause and then start again with a strong drink in your hand.
Hey, Jason, it's MW here, worlds of MW Lewis. Also author, by the way. We should not forget author of the adventure module, The Mystifying Marvel of Nicomedon's Tower, which is available at Smoldering Dung Games. But anyway, I was listening to your call-in show for Thanksgiving, very good. And I listened to the discussion on a prior episode about the gold standard in D&D. And you put something up about a website or a podcast we can go listen to or a video about this really uninteresting discussion. And I say uninteresting. And here's why. When you're gonna have discussions like this about, I don't think the currency system makes sense, or maybe you're more declarative, you don't say I think, maybe you say the currency system doesn't make sense, or mixing armor doesn't make sense, I hesitate to engage with people who make those kinds of declarations, because like some of your call-ins on your call-in episode already noted, it all depends. See, these kind of declarative statements should be qualified, and the qualifier should be depending on the type of game you're running. Now, I don't really run my games like a post-apocalyptic world. I don't really view the game as built on a post-apocalyptic world. I think there were some elements included in some of the modules written by Gary Gygax in particular. And there are some aspects of Greyhawk that suggest it could be some kind of post-apocalyptic world. But I never viewed the game that way, and I never run the game that way. I enjoy post-apocalyptic movies, but I don't, and I think the Blackmoor scenario might have been based somewhat on some kind of apocalypse that led to this kind of fantasy world. But that's not my cup of tea. I like the medieval, European medieval setting idea, that these fantasy worlds are more organically developed, that they don't necessarily have to follow some kind of apocalypse. But I don't know, maybe most of the literature is that way and I just don't notice it or whatever. But the point is, and those are fun stories too, and I like them, so there's nothing wrong with it. I just don't run my games that way. But when it comes to the rules as written, there's nothing wrong with the currency system in the rules as written in AD&D. Use the standards. Gold is fine. Who cares? I don't say who cares. People do care. If you're running a game and you want it to be more, you want it to more resemble a certain time or a certain society or Earth, our own European history, then you will change the standard. I mean, and there's actually nothing wrong with that. But don't make these declarations kind of implying that everybody else, at least is how I infer it, that everybody else who's just using the gold standard is running something that really doesn't make sense. That's ludicrous. It makes perfect sense. It doesn't, you know, it's just like our current paper dollars aren't based on anything, but we still use them. We still go out and buy things. So, yeah, you could just imagine, now why is there so much gold? Why is there a gold coin everywhere? Well, you just imagine you live in a gold-rich world, that's all. Or it doesn't even matter. Like, I would file this one for my games, I'm qualifying, as it doesn't matter. This is not an issue. It's not something I care to think about. Now, that all being said, in recent years, just to eliminate, and only to eliminate, over use of my mind and the minds of all my busy, tired, middle-aged players who click together at night, I have cut down on some of the currencies. So I just don't give out Electrum pieces, and I don't really give out copper pieces. I say copper pieces are used. So my system basically has the four coin choices: copper, silver, gold, and platinum. But when I give out treasure, I only give out the top three. I just tell the players that the copper pieces are so worthless that they're really for the lowest of the low peasants. I don't even use Electrum. And I don't do that because having those coins, and I don't say they don't make sense. I actually think they make a lot of sense, and they could really make for a rich game if that's what you want to do. But I do it just more to speed up the game a little bit, less time converting things. You know, I just make fast conversions if something's listed in the player's guide as copper. I just tell the players, yeah, it's a silver. And you know what? No one complains. It's just easier. We just want to cut down on the math a little bit. If we had more time, I'd use them all. I'd go back to using them all. It's a nice system. It doesn't bother me. But anyway, I wouldn't say they don't make sense just because I'm not using it. And I wouldn't say maybe it doesn't make sense because I've taken a lot of time to convert the system over to a more realistic system, which I think is people's tendency to just be kind of like dismissive of a system that they've taken time to think about, and in their opinion they've refined it, so they like to make these broad statements like it just doesn't make sense. It makes perfect sense. The game is perfectly playable. You could call gold pieces anything you want. You call them dollars, it doesn't matter. It's just a form, you know, it's just a mechanism to have commerce within your game setting. It's not supposed to be commentary on real tangible currencies of exchange that have existed on our planet. So that's it. And you know, I went back and I consulted with the dragons and the goblins of the Middle Ages in Europe, and they said they didn't even use silver or gold. They used different currency, like rocks and things like that, and the kobolds back then, you know, and the magic users and the magic wizard towers in Europe, the great ones in Switzerland, you know, and the great dragons in Switzerland. They didn't use any of this stuff. So we're really, you know, Gary got it all wrong because he didn't really consult with their histories. Well, anyway, thanks a lot, Jason. Good show. Talk to you later.
See, I kind of made fun of MW there before his call, but that was wrong of me because there are a lot of really good points are brought up in that 7-minute call. Even Gary Gygax, after leaving TSR and working on Dangerous Journeys, was using the term bucks for the currency because he thought it might be simpler, more relatable, and probably because he figured he might get sued over using gold pieces. I don't know. But it really, there's no question D&D is European-centric and kind of based on European ideas because that's what he was familiar with. But it's not supposed to be Europe. D&D isn't supposed to simulate 1425 France, right? It's, you know, I've got a copy of the Doomsday book, and it's really interesting, but that's not what the standard, it could be in your world if you want to use that, and you want to play a mudcore kind of game, you could use that to base your campaign around, but that's not what D&D necessarily is supposed to be, and it's not how it has to be played. There's nothing wrong with having the mixture of the full plate kind of jousting armor mixed together with armors from earlier times and weapons from different time periods mixed together. There's nothing wrong with that. And when we look at the art, especially in the earlier books, we see those kind of mixtures and different things in there. And it's not all one period. While your group definitely can tend towards the realism, the medieval realism, if they want to, you definitely don't have to. And the game, I don't think, pushes you to do that either. I think the game provides you a framework, and then you can do it with it what you want. That's kind of one big advantage of OD&D and AD&D over the later basic sets, where the basic sets are, although they can be flexible, and obviously you can do all kinds of things. We look at all the hacks that have been done for BX, for all these different genres and all these different things. But that said, I think the OD&D and Advanced D&D line of games are probably a little more open-worlded than the BX games. I think the BX games are more grounded. You have more limited choices if you're playing rules as written or trying to stick to the rules. Obviously, if you change the rules and, you know, all that goes out the window. But it's also interesting with the, you know, the older games that they really build on each other. So you kind of have to know chainmail to understand OD&D, and you kind of have to know OD&D to fully get AD&D. But then when they go to the basic lines, you can, and especially by the time we hit Mulvey and Mincer, you don't really need the other books. You can kind of just read those books and play with just those lines, where AD&D assumes some familiarity with OD&D, and OD&D assumes familiarity with chainmail. Yeah, I totally got off topic there. So I will gracefully just switch to the next call and pretend like that didn't happen.
Hey, Jason. Daniel from Mance, keep calling in about your... I see you have a new episode, but I haven't listened to it yet, about the Rule Cyclopedia episode. You know, it's interesting because I kind of have a similar story in a way. You know, I had heard so much about it. I was not around during Rule Cyclopedia time, and it was like vaulted as this like amazing thing. And I remember looking on eBay, and it was quite expensive compared to like just buying some of the box sets and stuff. And everybody was like, Rule Cyclopedia, Rule Cyclopedia. And then it, and I was interested in Mincer Basic because, of course, I was brought up on Mulvey. And then DriveThru had it available for print on demand, which I guess tanked the, the used market, maybe. But anyways, I got it, and honestly, I wasn't impressed. But I think maybe it's because I stepped into it thinking this is going to be the holy grail, and I was just kind of like, a lot of rules I'm not going to use. But you got me thinking maybe I should look at it again, give it a second look, because now with some fresh eyes. So I did pick it up and put it on top of my pile, and then quickly moved it to the bottom since I have about four other games I got to read. But I'll take a look at it again. You got me thinking about it again. And, you know, sometimes first impressions aren't what will stick with us. So, cool. Thanks for doing that.
Hey, Jason. Just calling about your Beck Me review. I guess when I was writing Broken Lands, I didn't realize we were using Beck Me, but we were, because we had, like, all these weird skills that every single species had. And, well, just using the humanoid species in general, right? So I guess that was Beck Me, and I didn't even realize it. I thought I was playing BX or running BX, but then Lord Eric Salzwedel corrected me. So yeah, we were playing Beck Me. And as far as skills go, I do like three or four skills per like attribute. I think that works really well. Twilight 2000 has four, and Walking Dead has three. So that ends up being like 12 skills for Walking Dead and 16 skills for Twilight 2000. I think that covers everything. Although it does lead to like a dependency on like the recon skill in Twilight 2000, which is used for stealth and observation, for example. But I guess that's okay, because that's what they're used for. And then you have specialties under there, so you can specialize in observing or specialize in being sneaky, and you get a bonus dice if you do that. Or I guess in Twilight 2000 it's an uptick. In Walking Dead it would be like a bonus dice, since that uses the more traditional Mean Year Zero D6 pool engine, which also Coriolis uses, which is an amazing game too. And I wish Daniel would talk about more Coriolis, truth be told. Anyway, yeah, Beck Me. I like it. I like the Cyclopedia. I did buy it eventually to supplement when I was running Broken Lands. But, you know, we did rely on Gaz-10 Orcs of Thar, which is a fantastic game. And I still got the Roll20 for it. I guess it's in limbo, but maybe, you never know, eventually. Maybe a special holiday Broken Lands. Holiday Broken Lands Christmas. Okay, bye.
There we heard from Daniel, who has the Bandits Keep Media Empire, and Carl, who we had previously heard from. Now, Carl has started putting things up on YouTube as well, so you may want to look for the Geomologist Presents YouTube channel if you like absorbing your media through YouTube as opposed to podcasts. As far as the Rule Cyclopedia goes, Daniel, yeah, I think where I fell into that trap and kind of got the same impression you did is I was looking for a game where, while it is a game, it's more like an SRD than what we would think of an SRD today, right? It's a reference guide. It's not a teaching you how to play the game, where the box sets, the Beck Me box sets, Mincer's box sets, teach you how to play the game. They are written to teach a kid how to play the game. So coming back as an adult, you know, it's maybe not the best experience, but they teach you, where the Rule Cyclopedia is just kind of like a reference guide. Which isn't a bad thing, but it's, you have to accept it for what it is. It's the same thing as going to a SRD online. You're not going to get the same experience you would out of a starter set. So that's kind of how maybe I look at the two. And I kind of prefer the rule book version as opposed to the SRD version. So that's one of the things that does turn me off to the Rule Cyclopedia. Now, as far as Carl's Call, yeah, the Broken Lands was fun. And I kind of am with you there. I think around 16 skills, maybe 4 per attribute are pretty good. Although, they don't have to be 4 per attribute, right? Because not every attribute is going to lend itself to certain skills. And I do like the idea of being able to mix and match what attribute you use, what the skills are. How do I say this? I do like the idea of being able to mix and match the attribute the skills associated with if your skill's value is based on the attribute value, if that makes sense. So if we go to something like the Gygaxian system MW is going to talk about that in the next call. And when he's talking about the Gygaxian system, he's talking about in his episode 227 over at the World's MW Lewis, he has an interview where they talk about the Gygaxian skill system. So you have to go, I don't want to steal his thunder, you have to go listen to that. But if you're using something like that, that kind of mixes in the attribute and the level of the character and things like that. So anyhow, I think that's about the right number of skills, though, somewhere in the 12 to 16 range, maybe 20 on the outside. But I don't think I'd want more skills than that, because the problem with skills are, once you have skills, you're assuming people that don't have the skill aren't going to be as good at doing it. And because you limit the amount of skills people get, you get characters that are unrealistic, in my opinion, that aren't, they just don't seem like real people because they're not skilled enough to do all the things we could normally do. You know, I find it hard to stat up a real person using most skill systems for a starting character. And when I say a real person, I'm talking about somebody that like was a military vet, now is a civilian occupation. That's going to be hard to get all those decent skills in there, and then you add in a couple hobbies, and it could be pretty tough. That's just my opinion. I know I've said that before, but I'm waffling here, so I'm going to turn it over to MW Lewis. Again, this is a long call. He talks about a lot of neat things. I'm very jealous that he got to go see the Ralph Bakshi Lord of the Rings at the theater. He's going to open up the call talking about that. So, like I say, grab yourself a drink to fortify yourself, and I'm going to turn you over to MW Lewis.
Jason, MW here. I was continuing on with your call-in show from Turkey Day, Thanksgiving Day, and listening to Eric's comments. And I can't really remember what he was referring back to, which show of yours, but I'm still out on my walk. I'm walking back from watching the Lord of the Rings cartoon, 1978. And I walked all the way to AFI to see the movie, about 3 miles from my house. So walking home now and listening, and I like Eric's comments. I think he makes a lot of salient points, and this gets to something I was talking about. Oh, I can't remember now. Maybe when I was talking with Queller or someone else, or maybe I wrote it somewhere. I can't remember now. But when it comes to like the Gary rule, using those skill checks, which we were calling, you know, Queller referred to as the Gary rule very loosely, because he took it off of Dragon's Foot Forum in the thread where Gary answered a million questions very graciously, by the way, a long time ago, back in like the late 2000, early, you know, the late noughts of the 2000s. But the idea is how in AD&D, running the rules as written, do you do skill checks? And let's not talk about Wilderness Survival Guide and the Dungeoneering Survival Guide, which is what the two volumes that really introduced this idea of rolling under your ability score, right? So now I also misspoke and said something like it's weird you get these ability scores and you don't really use them. Because of course, there are certain things tied to each ability that impact the game. So I kind of misspoke there. I guess what I meant is that beyond those identified things, like bending bars and pluses to hit and damage for strength, languages for intelligence, you know, saving throw bonuses with your wisdom, and that's big. That's a big deal. Let's be honest. And the dex, you really get a lot of great bonuses there too. So in a way, if you use the rules as written, those ability scores are pretty well fleshed out and important. I guess my point was, it's a little weird that people were left kind of homebrew ways to solve other challenges. And I guess really what I meant is the ability scores are a great opportunity to do those too, to solve other kinds of challenges. But there was really nothing written about it. So Gary came up with his rule. A lot of people did the whole roll under your ability to do certain things. And these are great. Now, like I said, I was discussing this, that if someone wanted to do something like find a trap or remove the trap, and they're not a thief, I would make them give me very precise instructions on what they're doing. And then I would determine whether or not they had a chance of success. But a thief character could just say, I want to find the trap, and I wouldn't ask them anything else. I would just simply say, roll the dice. Well, I might say, where are you looking for the trap? I mean, obviously, they'd have to say, I'm going to look at that chest and try to find a trap, or I'm going to check out that door. But beyond that, that's it. I don't need them to give me any other description. Like, I'm going to feel around, I'm going to sniff, I'm going to do this, that, or the other thing. We're just going to make the roll. For a non-thief, I'd make them give me a pretty elaborate explanation of what they're going to do. Because then if their description would not actually include looking at the area where the actual trap is, then they would have, like, no chance of succeeding. But if their description was pretty good, and it made it clear to me that they might actually find the trap, then I would give them a chance to find the trap. So what I would say there is, how would I then make that final determination? Well, some kind of skill check, right? So, and that gets into the question, how do you do that? Am I going to just use their abilities, make up something, use the Gary rule? One thing's for sure, though, and there's multiple, and I'm not calling about how you actually should do it, but my point being, if you're trying to mimic an actual skill for one of the defined roles in the game, i.e. a thief, or you're going to try to do something that a magic user normally would do, or a ranger, your chance of success has to be lower than those characters. It just has to be. It would make no sense to give a character the same chance as an equivalent level so-and-so. So if I'm looking for a trap and I'm a fighter, it doesn't matter what level. Even if I'm using the Gary rule, your chance would go up by level. But at some point, it can't be better than the equivalent leveled or higher thief looking for the same trap. I probably would never let a non-thief pick a lock under any circumstance. So then this gets to the other questions, other kinds of things that aren't really skills. And Eric brings up a really fascinating dilemma in the game that's built into the game. Now, this is something where you could say the rule doesn't make sense. And I just commented on why I don't like those statements. But sometimes there's some contradictions in the rules. Not really contradictions, but elements of the rules meant for game balance that are just really hard to wrap your mind around. And Eric brings up a great point. The magic user can't use the sword. Well, it is a little hard to wrap your mind around the fact that the magic user can function just like any other person in the game. Can pick up things, put down things, grab things, can swing a staff. He can literally put his hands around a wooden staff and swing it as a weapon. So what does that mean? He can't use a sword. Does it literally mean what Eric was describing, that he can't pick it up and just wantonly swing it in front of his face, hoping to keep a monster at bay? I mean, that doesn't seem right. He certainly could pick up a staff and do it. So why couldn't he just pick up the sword? Well, because there's really no explanation of how to adjudicate it. So some DMs and players will insist, no, I cannot do it. So you're kind of like stuck. So, and here's why. Let's say you're in a scenario and a number of the PCs are dead or otherwise incapacitated, and your magic user's out of spells, and he's already thrown his daggers, maybe he doesn't have a staff, and the only thing left on is a sword from one of his companions is lying on the ground. You as the DM might say, you can't use it, sorry, you can't use it. And the player might get all like, this is just kind of dumb, like it's just dumb. Or it could be the reverse, because this happened in one of my games, where the cleric didn't want to use a pointed silver weapon in the face of a lycanthrope because he kept saying, I can't use it. And I was just kind of like, all right, whatever. So how would I handle it? I actually think you should allow that character to actually use it, but at really stiff penalties, right? Like many, many things would happen and there'd be consequences of it. So let's go to the example of the cleric picking up a pointed weapon as a measure of last resort. I would allow him to use that weapon with a stiffer penalty than a non-weapon proficiency already detailed in the book, because it's not the kind of weapon he would normally train on. So the cleric would know how to cut with a knife. He would know how to use the knife as a tool for various things that he would do, but he wouldn't be training in the martial use of a dagger, knife, or sword. So I would say to that cleric that your non-proficiency penalty would increase by 5%. So your chance, your deduction to hit, or whatever, the subtraction from the armor class, however people do it, would, which in most cases is the exact same thing, not in all cases, but in some most cases, would increase by an additional one. There'd be a negative one added to your non-weapon proficiency. Now, I'm walking now. I think the cleric non-weapon proficiency penalty is, I don't know, minus 2 or 3. I can't think, but you add one, you make it one higher. Now for the magic user, it gets a little more interesting, because the magic user certainly can train in the dagger. He knows how to stab and poke with a dagger, so now he's got a big sword. He's not supposed to use the sword. Maybe he could just resort to only swinging it. Okay, so I would go beyond, for me, this might be how I'd do it. I don't know exactly how I would do it. I often like to just ask my players, what do you think? Because I play with people who are really experienced. You're one of them, Jason. Well, they're very experienced players. I like to say, what would you think in this case? And that's when you get a lot of them would say, I would never allow it at all. I just wouldn't allow it. And then I look at the other players and say, okay, well, what do you think? The ones who may allow it. So I'd say, how are we going to handle this? There's got to be a way to allow the magic user a moment of grace to try to save himself. Desperate times desperate measures, right? You're going to do something. And they're going to stand there and get killed. So I'd say, what are you going to do? So we try to work it out. Now, one thing I would propose is, if he describes his action, well, I'm going to pick up the sword and just swing it wildly to keep the monsters at bay. Well, I have to decide, do the monsters let him keep swinging it wildly? Do they come in and they'll attack him? Or do they try to overbear him or something like that? Hurl missiles, whatever. So if any one of those things would be adjudicated by normal rules. But if they come in to attack him, I can't say there's zero chance an untrained magic user can't hit with the sword, and even potentially for some damage. So what I might do is say, you will only hit, if you're just flailing wildly, you can only hit on a natural 20. And if you do hit on a natural 20, I'd have a steep penalty to the damage. And I'd say it'd be anywhere from like literally no damage to half damage, because he's not really trying to use the weapon to cause damage, but it was just by chance. He just by chance caused damage. And that'd be it. I wouldn't allow much more than that. Now with the cleric, it'd be different. I allow the cleric to roll a 2-hit with his proficiency altered slightly by 5%. And if he gets a hit, if he manages to get a hit, I let him roll for full damage. I'd say the cleric has enough martial training that even with a weapon that they're not supposed to use, they could roll for full damage. And I would do the same for a thief and other character types that get some martial training. But the magic user, I'd have the stiffest penalties. And of course, illusionists. You know, I just give them the stiffest penalties to be doing this. Now, but then there would be consequences, right? And obviously, this has been discussed by many people, but the cleric could have to serve penance, that you could give the characters lower ratings, and that might not make sense. The players could say, that's really stupid, because I was just saving my life, and that should, I shouldn't suffer any kind of penalty for that. Well, I would give them, now I know some, I know James, for instance, the Emperor, I've heard him say, I'm pretty sure, that he would give no experience points for that. I'd give the experience points. I would agree that you earned experience by doing it, but I would ding your rating. Now, maybe James doesn't do rating, and that's okay. Not everybody does. So I would ding the rating, and it might mean, as part of your training, you have to serve a penance. And then for the magic user, same thing. I would ding the rating, and you'd have to train more to think about how you could avoid putting yourself in those kind of situations. What more could I have done? So train more as a magic user so that you don't have to use, to borrow the phrase of Obi-Wan Kenobi, you know, the uncivilized ways of fighting with the sword. And that's how I would do it. Now, I can see that's how I would do it. I can see a lot of DMs just not allowing it and that's fine, because that's really rules as written. There's nothing in the rules that indicate it's possible to, you know, bend these rules a little bit. The rule is pretty clear. It says they cannot use these weapons. So, or any other DMs who might just be more generous and say, yeah, I'll always allow their use as a last resort, with or without penalty, on the usage of them. And maybe there's no consequence after. And that's okay too. I mean, I think if you're gonna do these kind of things, you have to talk to your players about it. That's what I would say. You really should talk to the players when these scenarios come up and bring them into the resolution. Because when you work with your players that way, you can make it more fun for everybody. And you can have a resolution that nobody anticipated, because by rule, it would seem impossible. And something fun might come out of it that you can laugh about later or talk about later. Now in game, I don't think your cleric would be walking around bragging about the fact that he stabbed someone with a sword. But he might say, in game, he might brag that he did save his companions once at great cost to his own integrity. And he is happy for that. And then your magic user might actually brag. Might say, man, I got myself in a pickle once.
Total distance 6 miles. Total time 1 hour 59 minutes and 13 seconds. Split pace 19 minutes 16 seconds per mile.
And I had to pick up this sword, which was so foreign, and the weight balance was something I'm just not used to, and I was just swinging it wildly, and I happened to kill an orc, and I saved my life, and I was able to save my companion's life by doing it. I'll never do that again, though. You see? Like, I could be in the game, but out of the game, you get something to laugh about. That was amazing. I can't believe I picked up that sword. I rolled a 20. And even with the penalty on the damage, I killed it. So and we survive. So that could be funny. But some people don't like when the game is funny. But I'm glad Eric brought these points up. I enjoyed listening to his comments.
And remember, folks, if you sent a call in to Jason and you haven't heard it on this episode, have no fear. It will appear.
Colin, thank you for that reminder. That was Colin Green of the Spike Pit podcast there at the very end. MW brings up a number of interesting points. I only want to hit two of them here, really. One is that skills should not make you better than the classes that do those things normally. And I fully agree with that. No matter how skilled you get to be, you shouldn't be better than an equivalent thief. So maybe if you're a 20th level character, you would have skills that would let you do something better than a first level thief. I might be able to get behind that. But if you're a first level character with a skill, that skill shouldn't make you better than a first level thief trying to do the same thing. If it's like a thiefy thing, like hide in shadows or stealth or something, you know, move silently, something like that. So, and that's one of the problems with the Rules Cyclopedia skills is that, like stealth, it makes you better at moving silently than an equivalent thief. Now, the thief can do it in all train types, where the skill lets you only do it one train type, but in that one train type, you're much better than a thief of the equivalent level. So that's a first level. So that's a big problem for me with a Rules Cyclopedia. That's why, like, Rules Cyclopedia have so many skills, and they're not all skills. Some of them are feats, you know, blind fighting or this or that. Some of them are really feats. They're not skills, I think. And that's kind of a problem. The other thing I will say here, and that kind of also goes into the idea with the weapon proficiencies for Rules Cyclopedia. So we'll slide into talk about the weapons. Because in Beckme Rules Cyclopedia, wizards can only use daggers. Period. There's an optional rule that says they can use staves and stuff. But by the book, if you don't use the optional rule, they can only use daggers. But they start off with two weapon slots. So what do you do with the other weapon slot? And then they get additional weapon slots over time. So every wizard in the Rules Cyclopedia is going to be a knife fighting master, because that's all they're allowed to do with those skills. So that's kind of silly too. I mean, they don't have to be, because in Rules Cyclopedia you have to go train and spend money and time to get higher levels of weapon mastery. But still, it's kind of a weird thing. Now, if we go back to the real game, the adults game, to AD&D, and we look back at MW's talk there about magic users using swords and things like that. Personally, well, I want to go on the record here saying that, you know, since the Grog Talk Emperor James said they would get no experience for that adventure, that, of course, is the right way to do it. And far be it from me to counter the Emperor, and shame on MW for suggesting the Emperor might be doing it wrong. If you need me to take stewardship over MW's holdings while he's under trial, I'm happy to do that. I just want to throw that out there. But on a slightly more serious note, AD&D handles us, because you have a non-weapon proficiency penalty, which in the case of the magic user is -5. So not only do you have somebody that's AC 10, you know, unarmored, and has a -5 to hit, but in addition to that, they're not going to, if they pick up that sword to hit, let's say they do hit, great. But they're not going to get any experience for the adventure, and it's going to negatively affect their rating when they do get rated to go level up, because they acted outside their class thing. So they're going to get dinged both in the rating system, they're not going to get any experience for the adventure, and they still have to deal with a non-weapon proficiency. But if they want to pick that sword up and have all those things go against them, that's perfectly fine. I don't have an issue with it. Now, in the case of like a cleric, then in addition to those same things, you would also have the issue of dealing with your deity for using that edged weapon, you know, and that would depend on the cleric and the deity, and that's something the DM is going to have to work out with the player, right? And it would depend on what pantheon they follow and all that kind of thing. But I could see penalizing like a cleric or maybe a monk. No, not a monk. Personally, monks should be able to use any weapon anyway. That's a whole nother rant. So I'll talk about monks on a different podcast. But I kind of think the fact that monks got watered down between OD&D and AD&D is kind of a sad thing. But yeah, anyway, those are my thoughts. This podcast has gone way long, so I'm going to cut it off there. But if you have thoughts on any of this, please call in. All the ways to reach me are in the show notes, and you can use all those same ways to call in your thoughts about the Conan movies for a Conan Christmas. Thank you to all my callers. I really appreciate it. Thank you to Ray Otis for the coffee cup clip art. Thank you to TJ for the wonderful music. And all I have left to say is be excellent to each other.
Your auntie or a joker by your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if I could shoot him dead. Bring on the gore, bring on the gore. I want some. Butcher is a dustman and your moil is by a tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away, don't look away, don't look away, don't look away. Well, the zombies are arising and the world has gone to heck. We're living for the dying and we're dying for the train wreck.